begin by reading the first verse from Bhagavad Gita, just to set the scene and to stimulate our minds about this very current subject matter. War is current, talking of peace is current, and Krishna consciousness is current eternally. This is text 1 of chapter 1 of Bhagavad Gita. The chapter is entitled Observing the Armies on the Battlefield of Kurukshetra. Normally, battlefields are not an attractive place to be, but actually there are some people who like to fight, and there are many more people who like the subject matter of war. That's why so many books about war are written, and so many movies, and there's so many news reports. People want to see what's going on. Therefore, so many journalists are risking their lives to be on the front lines. Why do they do it? They say, in order to get the adrenaline rush of being right on the battlefield, and also to become stars by giving the people front-line reports. So, you'd be surprised that many people are interested in battlefields. There are two fields of human endeavor that capture human beings' interest the most. One is romance and passionate affairs, the other is war. Human beings are perennially interested in these two subject matters because they're very absorbing. They're very exciting. Generally, not so many ladies are interested in battlefield accounts. Now, there are some, though. And men aren't interested so much in romance. There are a few. But anyway, these two areas of human activity are very engrossing, very absorbing, and so they capture human attention more than any other subject matters. Now, I'll read the Sanskrit for this first verse of Bhagavad Gita. Many of you probably know it, if you're from an Indian background. Dhritarashtra uvacha dharma chetre kuru chetre samaveta yayutsava mamaka pandavaschaiva kimakurvata sanjaya. This is the old king, Dhritarashtra, asking his secretary, Sanjaya, O Sanjaya, after my sons and the sons of Pandu assembled in the place of pilgrimage at Kurukshetra, desiring to fight, what did they do? Okay. Now, you have to bear in mind that when the blind old king, Dhritarashtra, is making this inquiry, both he and his secretary, Sanjaya, are not physically at the battlefield. But Sanjaya, the secretary of Dhritarashtra, has the mystic or psychic ability to see what's going on in a distant place. So even though Sanjaya is not at a battle of Kurukshetra, he's not near the battlefield, he can see by his psychic vision and give a report. This is not mythological. Many of you know that the CIA has spent millions of dollars developing the psychic skills of persons who can see afar without being physically present at that spot. In modern language, this is called remote viewing. So, right in your state of California, up north, at Stanford, the CIA was spending millions of dollars with groups of psychics, cultivating their ability to sit in a room in San Francisco or Berkeley and give reports of what was going on at a top secret base in Russia or China. So it seems that Bhagavad Gita is not so far-fetched or outlandish as some people would think it is. Right here in the first verse, you're confronted with things that are beyond the ordinary understanding. Sanjaya is not on the battlefield, yet King Dhritarashtra is asking him, what's going on the battlefield? As if Sanjaya is right there. Right from the very beginning of Bhagavad Gita, you should know that you're dealing with a standard of civilization far more advanced than what we have today. That's why Dhritarashtra is saying with such, like just talking about something ordinary. What do you see? Even though Sanjaya is not on the battlefield. Sanjaya's skills were not considered to be extraordinary. Just a usual ability to see what's going on far away, even though you're not physically there. Okay. So that's the beginning scene of Bhagavad Gita. Immediately you're plunged into a battle situation, a family feud that has turned into war. Some people feel uncomfortable with this. Why is the Supreme Personality of Godhead speaking transcendental knowledge in such a hostile situation on a battlefield between two opposing armies? In this way, is Krishna sponsoring war? Naturally, people have an aversion to war. They would hope that there'll be peace all the time. You know the slogan, just give peace a chance, and why does it have to be fighting? Why does it have to be military buildups? Why? Now, it's interesting to look at the world from a different point of view. Instead of looking at the world as if it's a peaceful place in which sometimes war breaks out, what happens if you look at the world as a place of war in which sometimes peace breaks out? Think about it. Just change your vision. Why should you just assume that things are peaceful and then occasionally there are these wars? Why not assume that war is going on and occasionally there's some peace? What do you think? Actually, the Vedic viewpoint will teach you a much more penetrating vision than you'll get from the evening news on television or Time magazine or Newsweek. The Vedic viewpoint will teach you that you can see wars going on so many levels all the time. Then you'll begin to wonder, where is the peace? First of all, Bhagavad Gita instructs that if you're actually an intelligent person, you'll see that all species of life have the spirit soul. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Sarva yonishu kauntea murtaya sambhavantaya. All the species of life are related to me because I am the seed-giving father of all the species. That means no matter what body a living entity has, Krishna is the father, and that means we're all brothers. We're all related, no matter what kind of bodily shape. So why is it that human beings can engage in the massive slaughter of animals just to satisfy their tongue? That is war. You may know that it's practically impossible these days to get into a slaughterhouse and make a film. I've tried. I've searched the internet. I've had others search the internet to try and come up with films in slaughterhouses so you can see actually what goes on. Those of you who eat meat, naturally you munch, but you do not connect your munching on the meat with the horrible activities going on in the slaughterhouse. And these slaughterhouses, the meat industry, doesn't want you to think about the horror of what you're actually doing by eating meat. So therefore, because of so much animal rights agitation, it's practically impossible to get into a slaughterhouse and take pictures. They're very uptight about it. Recently in New Zealand, some lady practitioners of Krishna consciousness, they successfully got into a slaughterhouse in New Zealand. They're not called slaughterhouses. They have a very nice name for them, which sounds more antiseptic. They're called freezing works, as if the animals love to be frozen. So they told the slaughterhouse staff that, you know, we're coming to do an economics paper, and because, you know, meat export is the number two source of income for the country, you know, we want to, you know, take pictures to document this great industry. So, you know, when ladies are very persuasive, they have their ways of getting into any situation. So the guy said, yeah, okay, we don't usually allow this, but in other words, you look like innocent girls. You couldn't do any harm. So he let them in, and they filmed the entire process. But right where they were getting to the end of the tour, to the part where you can see the cows being brought in, and then they're shocked, electric shock, and their heads are cut off, he started noticing that these lady devotees were getting a little, like, you know, it's just getting a bit too much for them. So he began to suspect maybe they've got soft hearts. Maybe they're somehow the compassionate for the animals. You know, I don't see them having a hard look in their eyes. They're starting to get a little, you know, slightly overwhelmed by what they're seeing. Then he stopped the tour right at the end. Okay, better go. I think we better end it here. It was amazing they got that far. So this is an example of war. When countless animals are professionally raised and slaughtered just to satisfy the human tongue. And it's not necessary for a human being to eat animals in order to be healthy. But they do it anyway. That's war. Now just think about it. The human beings have declared war on the cows, on the pigs, on the lambs. What else do they eat? Chickens. Anything else I've missed? Fish. This is war. Anytime you see any of those creatures, you declare, you perform an act of war upon them. You are meant for us. When is there going to be peace on that front? Then you can look inside the wombs of ladies. What's going on there? The womb has become a battlefield. It's not automatic that if a child is conceived, the child will take birth these days. Very easily, the child can be aborted in the womb. That's warfare. Some people have declared war on unborn children. Now, from the statistical point of view, you can see, when you look at it one way, that the birth rate, the life expectancy has increased. People are living a longer life. Now, what if you add into those statistics all the aborted babies? Then you'll see the statistics for life expectancy come down. But they don't do that. They don't count the aborted babies in with the statistics for measuring the average lifespan. So here you have two examples of war that are happening as everyday events, and very few people think about it. Warfare against animals. Warfare against unborn children. What more? Using Bhagavad Gita, you can get even more subtle than that. What about the war that goes on in your own mind as you struggle with uncontrolled senses? Krishna describes this in Bhagavad Gita also. Manasastani indiyani prakriti stani karshati. Krishna says that mamayamamsho jiva loke. All the living entities in the world are his parts and parcels. But they are struggling in this world with their six senses, including the mind. They're struggling in the oppressive material atmosphere. Now, how many of us think to make peace with our mind and senses? I'm going to stop the battle between the mind and senses myself. Very few people think like that. They're busy outside of themselves, trying to make so many external changes in this world, trying to make progress, trying to achieve their mark in this world, but how many can make peace within in terms of subjugating their own mind and senses? In this way, I'm giving you an example of how war is occurring all the time all around us, but we don't notice. The war against animals, the war against unborn children, and the war being fought with our own uncontrolled mind and senses. So how can there be peace? Where is the peace? Therefore, as I said before, it would profit us more to see that war is always going on, and just sometimes there can be what appears to be some kind of peace. Now, generally, when dealing with war between human beings, people view it as an unfortunate thing. Some say it's necessary, although unfortunate. Others say it's not necessary. Just make peace somehow or other. And then people usually who want peace at all costs, they find some section of society, human society, to blame. It's all because of the military-industrial complex that there's war. Or it's all because of the capitalists that there's war. Or it's all because of this, all because of that. Bhagavad Gita will teach you a much deeper analysis. It's very easy to say. It's all because of this section of human society. Or it's all because of this kind of political system. No, Bhagavad Gita will not support that. Those who are blaming this section of human society have to look in the mirror and see how, because of the individual lifestyle, such persons are contributing to perpetual war. As long as we cannot control our senses, that means we have declared war on material nature. We have this vision that nature, or this material world, exists for my pleasure. And with my senses, with my mind, I'm going to go to combat. You can see your senses like weapons. I've got my eyes, I've got my ears, I've got my tongue, I've got my skin, I've got my mind. From the Vedic point of view, the mind is also a sense. So with your senses and your mind, you go to combat. What's out there for me? What can I hunt for? You can go up somewhere, maybe Hollywood Boulevard or Santa Monica on a Friday night, Saturday night, and observe. Start looking at the people like they're hunting with weapons. Their senses are on the prowl. They're looking. Where are the sense objects? That's a war. Or maybe the men and ladies don't think that when they're trying to find a suitable partner, you're like a soldier on a battlefield. You've got to conquer the opposite sex. You've got to bring someone under your domination, and their resources have to be for you. Like some people are going after oil wells. Everybody knows about that. Ah, the war is just about oil. But what about Santa Monica or Hollywood Boulevard or any nightlife place on a Friday or Saturday night? Everyone's after their own individual oil well. The oil well happens to have two legs, you know, and is dressed in various ways. So, yes, it's a battle. Right? Isn't it so? The men, they'll... You know, sometimes after a Friday night or Saturday night, the men will get together with their friends and, I didn't get anything last night. Like, really? All the men know is true. I tried. I just didn't, you know, just didn't get a hit. Just didn't, you know, just, you know, couldn't exploit. Couldn't capture anything. And also the ladies talk like that too. So this is a war. You're trying to individually subjugate someone, use their resources for your own pleasure. Now everyone says, oh, yeah, well, so many wars are fought over resources. People now say it's all about oil. That's what it's all about. So how many of you would dare say about the wars that go on every day and night in human society, how many of you will say, it's all about sex? No, no one's going to say that. But that's a form of combat. You want to expropriate, you want to control, dominate, to assert your interests in the name of love. So I'm just giving you examples of different wars that are always going on. Okay, the soldiers, they dress in a certain way. You know, they have their chemical warfare suits on. Similarly, when people go out for Friday or Saturday night, they put on their battle dress in order to achieve their tactical aims, right? So what is the difference? There's war going on all the time. Why is it that we think that war is the exception and people are living in peace? Bhagavad Gita will teach you. People are not living in peace. They're not controlling their senses. They cannot control their mind. Therefore, there must be strife. The strife within soon manifests as strife without. Prahlad Maharaj, the 5-year-old transcendentalist, in the 7th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, told this to his father, Hiranyakashipu. He said, "Father, you're known as such a hugely successful conqueror. But I'm telling you, even though I'm a 5-year-old boy, what is the glory of your conquest when you have not conquered the senses? You've conquered everything around you, but you haven't conquered anything inside you. Therefore, all your victories are hollow." These are the words of Prahlad Maharaj in the 7th canto of Bhagavatam. Now, once we understand that war is always going on, naturally, we'll start to be able to look for a solution. But as long as we think that war is the exception and that generally there's peace, we'll be an illusion. We won't see what's actually going on. Just like an ordinary person who walks in the forest. Maybe you've done this yourself. You walked in a forest and you thought, "Oh, how peaceful. The trees, the birds, oh, the breeze, the fresh air. Oh, this is so nice." Yes, many of you have done that. Did you know that the forest is simply a huge battlefield? It's a struggle for existence. There's birth and death going on all the time in the forest. But you see peace. But the creatures in the forest who are the prey for another creature, they don't feel peace. So everything depends on your perspective. Bhagavad Gita will teach you the realistic perspective, that this material world is a place of struggling. Krishna says, prakriti stani karshati. The material world is known as the prakriti stani. It's an oppressive atmosphere in which you struggle. Now, I admit, it takes a lot of, what shall we say, clarity and a lot of self-honesty to see life in Southern California as a struggle. If I would say this in New York or Chicago, everyone would say, "Yeah, life's a struggle." But, you know, we're in California, and the living is supposed to be easy. Even if it isn't, you don't admit it. So Krishna in Bhagavad Gita doesn't make any exceptions. You don't find any verse in Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says, "This material world is a struggle, except in California." Verse doesn't exist. So, once you understand that indeed life is a struggle, just like you may be very wealthy, you may have fame, but still you're thinking, "How am I going to be happy?" So many wealthy people are not happy. Yet, we're surprised when a wealthy or famous person commits suicide. I know, for example, I spend a lot of time in the UK, and the most famous female model in the world, she's from the UK, you don't have to say her name, but, you know, she's got a drug addiction problem. And I'm sure all the ladies here, not all, but so many of them would think, "Oh, if I was that famous, if I had her fame and wealth, if I had her looks, I would be so satisfied." It's not like that. Mm-hmm. Now, she's got a drug problem. And she got angry when the newspapers in England started printing that she was visiting drug rehabilitation centers. Mm-hmm. Similarly, so many famous singers, male and female, they have drug problems, they thought about committing suicide. So this shows you that there's an immense struggle going on, that even wealth cannot protect you from it. Fame cannot protect you from it. An intelligent person starts to think about these things. And then why do these things pop out that are conventionally known as battles and wars? I've already pointed out that war is going on all the time on so many levels, but people are not willing to see that. The animals, the womb, their own mind and senses, or going out to enjoy on a Friday or Saturday night means going out to battle. You're roving in your tank through the city of Los Angeles, you know, looking for prey. So this is all battlefield stuff. Now, what about what you'll readily recognize as military warfare? You see, you cannot simply think that there's going to be a diplomatic solution to war as conventionally understood. This world is a place of action and reaction. So if you've declared war on the animals, you've declared war on unborn children in the womb, you're fighting a war with your own senses and mind, and you're using other human beings for your own sense gratification and stimulation, there has to be a reaction for that. And that reaction comes in terms of battles between human beings. If you simply start to get embroiled in what should be the diplomatic solution, what is the United Nations going to do or not going to do, you've missed the point. The point Bhagavad Gita will make is that unless you can stop the wars on all these other levels, you won't be able to stop the wars that are conventionally understood. The battles between human beings on battlefields cannot be stopped, because they are the reactions of all these other kinds of battles which are not recognized. Krishna will teach that in Bhagavad Gita. Again and again, there are the military kind of wars. And after every war, then there's a constant reflection and contemplation. We shouldn't have done it, or we should have done it quicker, or we should have used less force, or we should have used more force. How to avoid it in the future? It never stops. Because simply by diplomacy, you cannot solve the problems of material existence. The basic problem of material existence is action and reaction, karma. If you kill, you must be killed. If you are slaughtering animals in mass, then you must become slaughtered in mass in pointless wars. I remember when I was a teenager and the Vietnam War was being fought. Now, I remember my father. He was trying to establish a closer relationship with me. So I remember him sitting me down when I was 12 years old. "Well, son, what's your opinion about the war?" You know, he wanted to have a fatherly son talk with me. And I said, "Well, you know, I don't know." He said, "Well, it's quite obvious to me that if we don't fight the communists here, all of Southeast Asia will be lost. Like dominoes will all go down." That was mainstream thinking back then. Yes, you had half the American public were against the war and half were for. So he wasn't saying anything freakish. He was saying what was, you know, the government's idea. He was saying what most of the population, in fact, would think. "We've got to stop those commies somewhere. So we're going to take our stand in Vietnam." Now, what does everybody think about the Vietnamese War? How did we ever do such a thing? How could the whole country have been so foolish? But not everybody was thinking like that then. You see, the laws of karma have their effect. Later, you can recognize, "That was stupid. Why did we do that?" But no, not when it's happening. Because what's happening is actually not so much the particular reason for the war, but what's happening is karmic reactions have to transpire. This is the real way to see deeply into material nature. So, in fact, even while the Vietnam War was going on, now it's coming out that the presidents of the USA were all having their doubts. In 1965, years before the war finally came to a halt, President Johnson was saying, I don't know what to do about this. I don't think we can win this war. The Secretary of Defense was saying, well, you know, I don't see anything else to do except send more men. That means send more people to get their karmic reactions. What to do? Secretary of Defense McNamara said, we've got to increase the call up to 600,000 men. So you might get angry. How dare these old men in their safe offices dispatch hundreds of thousands of men to the jungles of Vietnam to risk their life? You can look at it in that way, but you can also look at it in another way, which is more profound, I think. Just see how using the agency of these foolish leaders, hundreds of thousands of men are getting karmic reactions. Some of them will die. Others will have to undergo the misery of being on the battlefield, even though they come home alive. It's a miserable, unforgettable experience. Just see how the laws of karma are acting. Even in 1965, now it's on the public record, Lyndon Johnson said to his wife, because Lyndon would record, as you know, all his conversations. He said to his wife, you know, I don't know what to do about this war. I feel like I'm in a plane, and I've got two choices, either to crash with it or jump out. I don't have a parachute. He was telling his wife that, and she was in such anxiety for him. She later revealed that she was in complete anxiety because her husband was just practically losing it over worries about the Vietnam War. And then even the White House aides around Johnson at that time, they have revealed they were thinking of sending him to a psychiatrist because he was going through such wild mood shifts. So you think, well, how can all this be happening and yet hundreds of thousands of people are on a battlefield? For what purpose? This is karma. Then you get into the 70s. What did Nixon say? When the obvious was being presented that, you know, it doesn't look like this war is going anywhere. He said, I'm not going to be the first president to lose a war. Now you might say, how horrible. Just because of the vain ego of one leader, so many persons have to undergo suffering. Even if they didn't die, even if they weren't killed, it's a very austere and suffering experience to be sent off, to be drafted to fight a war. Why is this happening? You can't just get hung up at the egos of the leaders. You have to look and see how karma is happening. And the same thing will go on again, because people have to get their karmic reactions because they've done stupid things, therefore stupid wars happen. Sometimes when there's war, you can't even figure out who actually lost and who won. It's like in World War II, the way the karmic situation worked. Okay, Japan lost, Germany lost. But what happened within maybe 10 years, 15 years at most, after they lost the battle militarily? They won economically. Because all their factories, industries were destroyed, so they had to build up again with all the latest technology. Whereas England didn't get banged up, and it had all its old factories and industries in place, and couldn't compete with Germany and Japan. So, who wins? Who loses? This is the way life is in the material world, a very complicated situation. So, in Krishna consciousness, we don't get riled up about this side or the other, I'll tell you quite frankly. We don't come up with simplistic solutions. It's all about oil, or it's all about the military-industrial complex, or it's all about the greedy politicians, or it's all about this. No. Those are superficial reasons, which can be true to varying degrees. But what is true at the most profound level is because people are waging wars on all these fronts that they don't recognize, they're getting reactions, and those reactions manifest as traditional military conflicts. Those are karmic reactions to wars against the animals, wars against the unborn children, wars against your own mind and senses, and exploitation of other persons, exploitation of the opposite sex. These are all kinds of wars that are going on all the time. How to make peace? Not by negotiations, not by diplomacy. Peace starts when people are given the education to control their mind and senses. People have to make peace within, and that is the purpose of Bhagavad Gita, to give people the knowledge for having internal peace, and then there can be external peace. When people are given the education to stop their karmic reactions, then there'll be nothing to suffer. If you can live your life so that you're performing non-karmic work, non-reactive work, that's what Krishna teaches in Bhagavad Gita, then you won't have these things hitting you in the form of war, natural disaster, sudden outbreak of a new disease. You can stop one kind of disease, and then another one comes. It's like now there's the SARS outbreak. They have to struggle to come up with a vaccine against that. You stop that one, another one will come. What's really going on? What's really happening is that material nature is administering reactions to us for our sinful activities. It's old-fashioned to use that word, sinful activities. But do we accept that there is a universal law of behavior? And if we violate universal laws of behavior, we get karmic reactions. That's what sinful activity means. Violating the laws of nature gives you reactions, which you must suffer. And those reactions manifest in terms of disease, war, natural disasters. Here in Krishna consciousness, we are very much concerned with peace, but we're concerned with a lasting, realistic peace. We're not interested in superficial analyses. We're not interested in superficial solutions. We want to get to the heart of the war problem. The heart of the war problem lies within each of us. Now, we're not saying that there shouldn't be any superficial efforts to negotiate and have diplomacy. That can go on. But people should understand that is not the main thing. The main thing is that the people have to have knowledge how to have internal peace. And that is what Krishna is trying to do in Bhagavad Gita, to give transcendental knowledge so that people understand how to make peace within themselves, and then they can make peace among themselves. The amazing thing about Bhagavad Gita is that Krishna is teaching this knowledge of peace on a battlefield. Why? To provoke our thinking. Krishna seizes the most dramatic kind of situation. He's speaking to Arjuna, his devotee, in between two opposing armies. So this really focuses your attention on what's being said. It's a very challenging circumstance, and Krishna knows it. Lord Krishna knows that you're going to be thinking, if he's God, what's he doing on a battlefield? But Krishna not only comes on battlefields, Krishna also goes to the forest and sports and dances. Krishna does all the arenas of human activity that we know about, but he does them infallibly and he does them perfectly. Therefore, Krishna explains he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Why shouldn't Krishna speak on a battlefield? Why shouldn't Krishna sport in a forest? When you are the Supreme and everything is your energy, you have a right to do whatever you like. And whatever you do is for the benefit of everyone. Therefore, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna establishes that whether he's on a battlefield or he's in a forest or he's in a city, his activities are of the greatest benefit for all living entities. That is why we say, Lord Sri Krishna, Bhagavan Krishna, the supreme possessor of all opulence. Only Krishna can actually give lessons in peace, because all the energy emanates from Krishna. Therefore, If we'll take Bhagavad Gita more seriously, we'll get truly profound insights into what is peace and why there is war. Any questions? It's a long subject, interesting subject. I could go on for a long time, but... Please think of... Yes? I'm sorry, what's that? Yes. This Archita, he's our resident computer multimedia expert. He's produces many wonderful videos, and he's asking what we do with the footage. Maybe you can help. They shot it in Super 8, so they have to find a place that can transform the Super 8 to contemporary medium. So they're looking now. If they can find a place, I'll let you know. Maybe you can help. Because it's so difficult. You'd be shocked. Maybe you know how difficult it is to get into a slaughterhouse. The meat industry is really uptight. And so they just don't let photographers or camera persons in because they're afraid. They don't want the public to see. If any of you are meat eaters here, I say just actually try to see how animals are slaughtered and see if you'll go on eating meat. The meat industry knows that. Recently, in Australia and New Zealand, the meat industry took out advertisements on television in which they were taking a kick at the Hare Krishna movement because they're very angry that so many people have become vegetarians because of Krishna consciousness. So they got some butchers wearing, white butcher's clothes, and the butchers were imitating a Harinam party. The butchers were formed two lines and were... walking down the street, swaying back and forth, and they had a frying pan in one hand and a meat cleaver in the other, and they were banging, and like a Harinam party, and they had people, watching, and, like people do when they see devotees chanting on the street, they smile. So the people who made this advertisement had studied the Harinam party. So they had the same kind of thing. They had the people watching, which was appreciation. And the butchers were, marching in, two columns together, banging their frying pans with their cleavers, and they were singing, high in protein, high in protein, high in protein, high in protein. Horrible. So what we did in New Zealand was we put up a fuss. We contacted the television station, said this is a direct insult to the sacred religion of India. It's a direct insult to those who are practicing Krishna consciousness. The TV station contacted the meat industry, and the meat industry said, Krishnas are just going to have to get used to it. In fact, they said they're just going to have to eat it. Because, this is a good advertisement. We're getting a good effect from it, So they went on playing the advertisement, the butchers swaying it back and forth, high in protein. Then at the end, they flash on the TV screen, eat more beef. So we didn't give up. We contacted the government bureau that supervises or is like a watchdog for advertising, and we complained to them. And so this bureau reviewed the advertisement and after 2 hours said, there's no way this ad can go on. And so they took it off the air. They yanked it. They told the TV station and the meat industry, this is not going to make it. This is insulting. So that was a minor victory. But that shows you why is there war when you have advertisements like that. Yeah. In which people are being encouraged to slaughter. Eat more meat, eat more beef, it's high in protein, as if you're going to die without it. Here you have a whole community that doesn't eat meat, and people are looking very healthy. But, you look at the advertisements on TV, high in protein, you must have the flesh. And then people wonder, why is there war? Why are hundreds of thousands of people sent to die for ridiculous causes, which later everybody laments? Why are just the whims of a politician, just like I'm not going to go into the rights and wrongs of the current conflict. I'm not going to get into that. But I will tell you it's very expensive. That's all I'll say. Just to send all the soldiers over there, just to send them, costs $23 billion U.S. dollars. Just to send them. Now, everybody likes to see, you know, those Mohawk helicopters flying in. Each one of those helicopters costs $10 million U.S. How much does one cruise missile cost? $1 million U.S. dollars. A fighter airplane? $33 million. A tank? $3 million. So I'm not going into the right or wrong of, you know, should we be there, should we not, this, that. No, I'm just pointing out it's a very expensive activity. Yeah. Will it stop just because of diplomacy? No. Will disease stop just because if they get a vaccine against SARS, will that mean the end of disease? No, another one will come. Similarly, you make a diplomatic solution to one war, another war comes. Because human beings do not know the art that Krishna is teaching in Bhagavad Gita about how to make peace at the deepest levels so that the superficial conflicts are avoided. This is why Krishna consciousness is of the utmost need today. Yes?
So perhaps when there's war going on around us, perhaps that's one proactive way to respond to it is to increase our devotion.
Yes, that's true. Increase our devotion and teach the knowledge of Bhagavad Gita so people can see what a real solution is. Yes?
Aside from the karma that one individual sees out individually, why is one forced to connect with karma?
That's how nature organizes it, that groups of people who are supposed to get their karmic reactions do it together. In one way, when looked at from another point of view, it's kind of convenient, isn't it? Gather a bunch of people who are due karmic reactions, and in one swoop, they all get their reactions. Disease does that, epidemic does that, war does that. Any else? So please remember, this knowledge of Krishna consciousness is of utmost importance right now. It's not pie in the sky. It's not some kind of information that's, well, yeah, it's kind of interesting. Well, we'll see. No, we have to make the peace within and also establish peace amongst all species of life. Then the way for human beings to live peaceful will become clear. This is the knowledge that Krishna is teaching in Bhagavad Gita. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.